Podcast listeners, you've listened to the podcast. Now you want the chance to come on the program yourself. So here it is. Do you remember those books, Choose Your Own Adventure, where you would pick where to go next and follow that story? Well, help us flesh out the VitBuckle Society complication session at the annual meeting in March 2020 by submitting your surgical videos of your complications in vitreoretinal surgery. These videos can be narrated or anonymous with the description to mklufas@gmail.com. That's mklufas@gmail.com. We all learn more from reviewing our mistakes as groups and with our colleagues, so this is a great learning opportunity. And two big things, the top five entries will be shown during the meeting and discussed by a panel discussion, but more importantly, if you're one of the top five entries, we'll invite you to come on the podcast for a one-on-one interview to discuss the case and learning points. The winning entry out of the five will then win a special VitBuckle Society buckle, so send your entries to mklufas@gmail.com. That's mklufas@gmail.com. Thank you.
Hey, this is Ed. So this is a podcast, is that right?
This is.
Okay. We're officially podcasting right now. That's awesome.
This is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Welcome to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, a retina podcast. At least once a week, we aim to bring you insights and perspectives from the world of vitreoretinal surgery. I'm your host, Dr. Jay Schreeder. Today on episode 205, I am joined by the Physician Philosopher, a blogger and writer who focuses on the topics of physician financial independence and burnout. Remember, a list of financial disclosures will be attached in the episode description. Also remember that for certain podcast episodes, you can claim CME credits via the AAO website. Straight from the Cutter's Mouth is now happy to be joined by Dr. James Turner. Dr. Turner is the owner and creator of The Physician Philosopher, which is a website he's here to talk to us about that has a subtitle, Fight Burnout with Financial Independence, designed for physicians. The website can be found at thephysicianphilosopher.com. That's thephysicianphilosopher.com, and we'll have a link for that website up. And he's also the author of The Physician Philosopher's Guide to Financial Independence, which is a great book kind of summarizing a lot of the principles that he has on the website, and it's available also in a mobile fashion as well. Jimmy, thanks so much for joining us and taking the time.
Yeah, Jay, thanks for having me on.
So let's give, usually I ask people, we have ophthalmologists come on, we ask them why they chose ophthalmology or retina, but you're in a different field. And so I think it's interesting to see. So let's give some background. Why did you become a doctor? And then how did you subspecialize? And why did you make that choice?
Yeah, so I guess going way back, the original reason that I wanted to become a physician is to do mission work, actually. And so, which I've done a little bit of since then. But that was the original impetus for joining medical field. I chose anesthesia because there was a big need, honestly, in that regard. And I also found that, you know, I liked a little bit of everything in medical school, but I did gravitate towards procedural specialties. And then I really liked the intellectual aspect of anesthesia. So, you know, you make decisions, you make diagnoses, and then you implement a treatment plan or, you know, how you're going to correct a patient's problem, and you can watch it happen right in front of your eyes. And so I always thought that was pretty cool. Lots of immediate gratification. And similar to your field, the procedures that I do in regional anesthesia, which is what I ended up subspecializing in, where, you know, we perform peripheral nerve blocks, our procedures don't typically take very long. So there's, you know, kind of a variety of procedures that we do, and they are, you know, really important for decreasing pain and opioid use, which is, you know, a big deal nowadays. And they're fun. So I really just kind of enjoyed doing that. So that's kind of what led me into it. And I started research, and, you know, I'm kind of got the whole academic gig going now.
So let's transfer to talking about this website, and maybe that kind of ties into your own personal journey. When did the idea of kind of financial independence, burnout, kind of take the forefront? When did you start kind of understanding this idea and thinking more about it? Because I'm sure that prefaces you starting the website.
Yeah, exactly. So I was a fellow doing my regional anesthesia fellowship, and I started coming across websites, blogs, books, and really kind of caught on to the idea back then. So that was about, I don't know, 3 or 4 years ago now. And the thing that was interesting to me at the time was that, you know, the White Coat Investor was out there, Physician on Fire, Passive Income MD, all these websites. And then there's several podcasts too that already existed. And yet I would have conversations with my residents and with attendings about personal finance. And despite all of the stuff that was out there, there was still such a huge just financial literacy gap. So it showed me that there's still a big need despite what is currently what was currently there to teach people these topics. And then I started to marry these ideas of, you know, burnout and financial independence, because I started, like anyone in our field, started noticing how big of a deal burnout was and how prevalent it was. And a lot of the talk around it at the time was really focused on individual solutions that honestly weren't very helpful. And I started realizing that one of the reasons that people start burning out has to do obviously with the work aspect of things. And then the other part is that we trap ourselves in this lifestyle that we can't really afford in terms of, you know, making long-term successful financial plans. And the reason we do that is because we're so unhappy that we try to buy our way to happiness and find out that it makes it worse. And so I started marrying these two ideas of using financial independence or financial freedom to fight burnout and also to prevent it, because honestly, a lot of our financial decisions make our burnout worse. So it's kind of how it started.
So let's talk a little bit about that concept, right? And you've probably gotten a lot of feedback from people and a lot of stories from people. I think that sometimes, having talked to Jim Dolly previously in Physician on Fire, I think some of the interesting thing is just the wide variety of stories people bring up. And so let's talk about burnout first. So let's dig deeper. Why is burnout such an issue in our generation of physicians? And how do we combat this? Now I'll bring up two ways. You know, we can approach this each individually on an individual basis, individual physician. How do they prevent themselves from going burned out? And then as we're talking about the future of medicine and as a group, what sort of things can we do to prevent burnout in the next generation of physicians?
Yeah, so I like that you separated those two things because I do the same exact thing. So burnout in terms of the cause of it, I guess we have to talk about that first before we can talk about solutions. But, you know, the way that I think about this is there's some psychological studies that were done. I think it was by Ryan and Deci, is DECI. And they basically looked at like what makes you satisfied at work. And ultimately, there are three kind of characteristics. And one of them is competence, so being good at your job. The other is relatedness. So you have support from your administrators, the people working around you. And then the other one is autonomy. And if you look at medicine right now, what's continually happening each year and kind of getting worse as we go along is those things are being stripped from us. So, you know, we're clearly still competent at what we do. We're highly trained and highly, you know, educated to do the craft that we do. But when it comes to having support from administrators or support from peers or people that we work with that we feel like are really helping us accomplish our goals, that's starting to be pretty lacking. And then autonomy obviously is the big one. So when we have electronic medical records that tell us how to do our job, or pre-authorizations for procedures that, you know, patients are or not approved for, and, you know, the administrators who don't practice medicine anymore or never did are telling us how to do our job, like all those things result in a stripping of autonomy that ultimately prevents us from providing the care to patients that we know they need. And you know, that's where the term moral injury comes about. And so it's a complicated topic because the system's gotten so big and it's so, I don't know, it's just such a big machine that it's broken and it's very challenging to fix. And so when you look at that from a solution standpoint, there are really two different styles of solutions. One is individual solutions, the other is systematic. The systematic, I think, are much more complicated. But individually, like, what can we do as physicians? What control do we have over our life that would allow us to kind of fight back to, you know, on this problem? And the solutions are, they vary depending on your practice. I mean, you might be able to hire a scribe and help with, you know, non-physician tasks, you know, other secretarial responsibilities, things that you may be doing that potentially other people could do. But then really where the rubber meets the road for me is with financial independence. And so how I see that as a solution is, as I mentioned earlier, the mistakes we make, we dive into the system that, you know, we expected to be this just bright light at the end of the tunnel when we're in training, and find out that all those things happen. The autonomy has been stripped. You know, the administrators don't really support us. They, you know, give us RVU goals and other expectations that we can't live up to, or, you know, we don't have enough time with patients. And ultimately, if you have financial freedom, you don't have to deal with as much of that, because you can kind of fight back a little bit and potentially go part-time, or you can potentially, you know, step away from medicine altogether, which I'm not a big fan of the FIRE movement, but, you know, some people choose to do that because it's so bad. But more importantly, what you can do is prevent the big mistakes that most people make when they finish training by buying the house and the cars and all that stuff and inflating their lifestyle. So that's the individual component.
Yeah, and we'll talk about the financial part in a second. It's really interesting that you talked about those components because it's a really interesting way to subdivide it. And it's kind of a, like you said, the combination, right? I think people start feeling unhappy when they feel trapped. And right. I think that that's a balance. Not everyone feels completely trapped, but I think that the simultaneously increasing financial burden, the debt, the loans, and hearing about it all the time too. I mean, having it weigh kind of in your psyche, hearing about how reimbursements are going down, hearing about how your loans are worse and worse. Obviously, those things are true. You need to know about them. Putting your head in the sand like an ostrich isn't going to fix it. But I think sometimes mm-hmm. we get really negative in our conversations about our field. And that can be our generation, mm-hmm. the generation above us, talking about how it used to be better. And those things are definitely true. But you hear about this all the time on one end. And then on the other end, you're like, well, I'm trapped because I don't have autonomy. I'm getting boxed in. I don't necessarily have a way out. And unfortunately, we've seen many examples of burnout leading to suicide at the medical school and training level where people just get overwhelmed, I think, right? It's just too much to kind of process. And maybe medicine's always been stressful. And unfortunately, there's always been an instance of suicide and depression in medicine. And I think these things are maybe just tipping the balance further down that side. And so like you said, by teaching better financial principles maybe helps people feel more confident or less, more secure, at least understand that, yeah, you know, I did take out a lot of loans, but if I do this the right way, I'm not necessarily going to be trapped and I'm going to have some choices. Because I'll be very honest, when I was an intern 10 years ago, I had moments where mm-hmm. I was really low as an intern where I considered walking away just because, you know, and part of it just really had to do with being around people who were being really, really negative about medicine. Sure. And I'm very happy with what I do now. And like you said, we're both in different fields than some other fields in medicine because of what we do. But I just think that sometimes it's the narrative. There's a fine line between being really honest about where our field is. And yes, the system is broken and everything is. But that sort of negativity and not having necessarily positive conversation about it also, I think, is tipping our younger generation towards a negative side.
Yeah, I think it's tough because when it comes to finances, you know, personal finance decisions, money kind of cuts both ways. Mm-hmm. So if you aren't financially literate, you don't know a lot about this stuff, money can really trap you even more into that job that you don't love. So it's very easy to spin that in a negative way. However, if you do learn this stuff and you put a little bit of work in and you figure it out, then it actually frees you from that kind of broken situation and allows you to stand up and say what you think and maybe make some changes or, you know, look for a different job or maybe go part-time. I mean, it just provides so much more flexibility to your decisions. And so it can be a very positive thing if we let it. Unfortunately, most physicians don't know a lot about money. And so it can often, you know, kind of turn into a negative narrative.
So let's talk about money a little bit. And I used you have a great way of organizing your posts on your website where you really just put the most popular posts organized. And that's really helpful because that's like a self-feeding thing. The ones that people find the most useful are the ones people are going to find when they look on your website. And so the most popular post you have listed there is how much money do doctors make and why it doesn't matter. And so what exactly are you talking about there? And this is probably important again for financial planning. What if you're a resident or a fellow who's just finishing training, you're leaving, why is this important to kind of process and take in as you go out in the world and start, you know, making an attending salary?
Yeah. So really the biggest point there is that, and I mean, we see this all the time, right? When the public talks about wealthy people, you know, they just define it arbitrarily. I've seen some people refer to that as, you know, making more than $100,000 or, you know, various just kind of ways to define in their idea what rich means. And I think the problem is that we've really kind of married the idea of wealth and income. So just because you make a large income doesn't mean that you are wealthy. And, you know, there are lots and lots of examples of this in our own field. So I think the numbers are like 65% of, it's like 50 to 60, maybe 65% of physicians that are 65 or older can't retire and maintain their current lifestyle. So it happens in our profession. We see it in professional sports. We see it, you know, in celebrities. Like, just because you're earning a lot of money doesn't mean you're wealthy. And the reason why is because they didn't take that income, spend less than they make, and then invest the difference and actually become wealthy, independent of the money they're bringing in. Because the second that that money stops coming in, you have nothing. And so in the public's eyes, you know, when they think, how much money do doctors make? And they see the numbers that are out there, you know, we make $200,000-$400,000. They just gawk at it in a way. You know, it's just so much money compared to the $55,000 median income that most households make in our country. And so the really where the rubber meets the road on this is that it's a very, very easy equation. Earn a good income, spend less than you make, and invest the difference. And even though that's very simple in terms of the concept, it's very hard in practice because it is human nature to spend what you make. And so that's kind of the idea behind that post is that, you know, we do make high incomes, but if you don't learn how to think about money and learn the behavioral finance side of money and being disciplined and automating your finances, then it really won't matter. And you'll still end up broke at the end.
So one of your other popular questions or posts is this idea of the three kinder questions for life planning. And I thought this was great because I think this is a really important thing. Because I think you're kind of reading through your posts and reading your website, I think yours is, like you said, you're filling a niche because there's a lot of people talking about financial planning. I think you're approaching things sometimes in a more realistic fashion. And, you know, you're not simply saying that you can never spend more, for example, on things. It's just about knowing if you can afford to spend more. And sure. So when you're talking about designing your life, these questions, the three questions are design your life. You know, you have less time and today's the day. How did you come up with this concept and why is it important to kind of think about these things when planning out your life?
Yeah. So, you know, my website focuses a lot more on the behavioral finance or the psychology of money side of things. I cover, you know, lots of other topics too, but that's really where one of my passions is. And the reason why is because if you don't know why you're doing what you're doing, it doesn't really matter how to do it because you're not going to do it. You have to have a why. And so these three questions kind of come from that angle, and they come from a guy named George Kinder, who is a life planner. He's a financial advisor who uses these questions to basically help people figure out what's important in life. And so they're actually a ton of fun to go through. They create great conversations. So I always encourage people to, you know, go on a date or, you know, take a friend, have a drink and go through these questions and kind of see where it leads. And you'll be pretty surprised what you end up determining is actually important to you, because the ideas you have beforehand won't actually end up being what it is. So there's three questions. The first one is basically you are independently wealthy all of a sudden. Let's say you won the lottery or you woke up and, you know, someone died and you inherited a bunch of money. So money is not a thing anymore. You're financially free. You are secure. If you didn't need to earn another paycheck, how would you live your life right now? You know, what would you do with the money? Like, would you keep going to work? Would you stop going to work? Would you, you know, build a business, or would you, you know, like, what exactly would you do? Don't hold back. Design your ideal dream life based on the fact that you have as much money as you could possibly dream of. So that's the first question, and that will generate some pretty good conversation. And the second question is a little different. So money is not secure for you. But you've just found out that you have 5 to 10 years to live. You could die on the first day of year 5 or the last day of year 10. Knowing that information, you know, and it's going to be a painless death. Like, you're not going to hurt while that's happening, but knowing that that day is coming, what would you do differently right now? Knowing that you have a finite amount of time on this earth, would you change your life? Would you change your direction? Would you work more, work less? Would you not buy the house you're thinking about buying? You know, how would that impact your life? And the third question kind of follows in that vein, which is that you now have found out that you're terminally ill. You're going to die tomorrow. Looking back on your life, what would you be really glad that you accomplished? What would you be upset that you didn't? You know, what kind of legacy would you leave? What would you wish that you did? And when you go through those three questions, it's really amazing because you start realizing that certain things get left out. Like, you're not talking about houses and cars and private schooling for the kids. Like you're talking about spending time with family. You're talking about, you know, experiences and things that you did for other people. And so it really starts to draw in this narrative of what's important in your life. And you'll realize that you're spending money on a lot of stuff that isn't important to you. And so if you get the why, where you want to be, where you want to go, how much time you have to get there. This really does kind of provide that motivation to do the right smart financial things, to enjoy today while you're preparing for tomorrow.
Yeah, that's really well said. And I think, again, like I really appreciate the fact that you think from that way, because this is going to tie into the last of those favorite posts I'm going to talk about, but this idea of the 10% rule, you know, people, when they're financially planning, I think when you leave residency, one of the things I think is really important is you're making a lot more money. I think it's unrealistic to tell somebody, don't spend any of that money. I mean, it's just not going to happen. I mean, I think you have to experience some benefits, like, and do something, and you don't want to be, you could, I mean, I'm sure there's people who have done it. They're outliers who just didn't spend any money more when they left residency or for training, but you're going to spend some of that. So talk a little bit lastly about 10% rule and what it means for lifestyle creep.
Yeah. So, I agree completely with what you just said. So when you finish training, you just spent 4 years in college, 4 years in medical school, you know, 3 to 7 years of additional training and potentially more for some. And so when you finish that, the natural thing to do, to want to do, is to really celebrate what you've earned, right? You've taken the hard road and you're now earning this attending paycheck. And unfortunately, most people just spend it all, as we've already discussed. And so what I came up with was something called the 10% rule. And this really, really helped my family achieve a lot of success in the last couple of years. But basically, the idea behind this is you look at your last paycheck as a resident or fellow, and then you look at your first paycheck as an attending, what your anticipated pay would be, and you take 10% of that difference. So say that, you know, you're going to get paid $10,000 more post-tax as an attending. Well, now you get to take $1,000, 10% of that, and you get to spend it on whatever you want to. So I don't put a box around this. I don't put people in a box, I should say. You can do whatever you want with it. And so I'll give you an example. So my wife and I, we financed a car, and which I would not recommend for anybody, by the way. But that's what we did. And then we also bought a country club membership because I like to play golf, and there's a pool for my kids, and there's a free driving range and a couple of golf courses. My kids like to play golf with me. And then we did a couple other things, but like basically, even though those things aren't financially sound decisions in terms of like, we could have put that money into, you know, the total stock market index fund and reaped great rewards 50 years from now. They were something that we all enjoy as a family and would allow us to really enjoy that step up in pay that we had. Now, the caveat here is that the other 90% went where it needed to go. So I ended up paying $200,000 in student loans off in 19 months. And we increased our net worth by, I think, $500,000 basically in 2 years. And so I never once felt like I was lacking in that situation, because I actually still took a bump in lifestyle. I still had some lifestyle creep and really enjoyed it. But I didn't have so much lifestyle creep that I couldn't do financially wise things. So I did both. I really enjoyed today. And I also, you know, we were preparing for tomorrow. So that 10% rule allowed us to accomplish that.
Well, Jimmy, I really appreciate you coming on. And again, the book is Physician Philosopher's Guide to Personal Finance. It can be found on Amazon as well as on his website, thephysicianphilosopher.com. And I appreciate you taking the time to talk about these topics. We have a lot of fellows and residents. We've done a lot of speaking to them in this podcast. Any final take-home words, anything you'd want to say before we break?
Well, I guess it's the last, 6 months of training for some of those. And so if you haven't already gotten disability insurance and life insurance, if those things are appropriate for you, please make sure to do that, because there are special discounts in training. And that's actually a part of my story that got goofed up in the beginning, because no one ever told me to make sure that I did that. And then when I did it wrong. So figure that stuff out, protect your income. And then when you do, enjoy some of it and do the smart thing with the rest.
Thank you so much for your time. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on, Jay.
As always, you can find this episode and all prior episodes on our website, retinapodcast.com. That's RETINApodcast.com. All 205 episodes, including this one, can be found there sorted by category. We've had a couple other episodes about financial topics, financial planning issues. White Coat Investor came on early. Chirag Shah and I had a long conversation about this. So if you're interested in the topic, we do have other resources on that topic. You can also find our blog, Equal Round Reactive Lessons from Our Pupils.
On the website, you can sign up for our mailing list to get updates on the most recent episodes. At the bottom are links to subscribe in the Apple Podcast and Android Store. Remember, there are CME credits for select podcast episodes available via the AAO website. Log in as an AAO member, visit the link in each of the episode descriptions. We are on Twitter at Retina Podcast. You can contact us there or click on the Contact Us link on our website or email us at retinapodcast@gmail.com. We love the feedback you guys leave, the positive reviews. Everything keeps us going, so thanks again. And any episode ideas, just please send them in, and we're happy to accommodate if we can. Many thanks to the physician philosopher for taking the time to join me today. Thanks to Dr. Louis Kai, Dr. Angela Chang, and Dr. Michael Van Incasa for everything they do preparing this episode and the rest of the episodes. Listeners, thank you for listening. Thank you for what you do on a daily basis. The patient care you provide, the articles you read and publish, and the conversations you inspire here each week. This is Jay Schreeder, signing off.
Good feeling.
This is straight from the cutter's mouth.